Anyway, we have a topic for this session.
Yeah, we read and we're responding to, or we're just reading through or reviewing an article from the New Yorker.
The New Yorker, give us the issue.
It's the August 21st issue of the New Yorker, and it's the critics. A Critic at Large, Out of Action, Do Protests Work? By Nathan Heller.
So this is sort of like a book review of three books that touches on several related topics. I think it's three books.
I think it was three books on protest.
Yeah.
And in protest movements and like that.
So we wanted to talk, this is a relevant, you know, ripped out of today's headlines topic.
Dun dun.
We kind of wanted
but not. It's also, I think it's timeless, honestly.
Sure. But, so Grace has the baby on her lap if you hear his lip smacking and rustling going on. And there's always the danger she's going to grab your mic and pull the whole stand over. And
yeah, I like to live dangerously.
Yeah. So anyway, she's here with us because better inside the tent pissing out or something like that.
Something like that.
Anyway.
Better inside the tent squirting out, right, baby? Yeah. Right.
So you read this, and I read it. I read it like a week earlier than you did.
Sure.
And I, how do you want to do this? Would you?
Yeah. What's your first take on this article? What do you think's going on here?
I felt like it had some interesting points. There were some things in it that I felt were good points to make, and you know.
Yeah, come on. Why don't you go ahead and highlight your good points, and then I'll talk about what you know. What I'll talk about what he goes through. And then I'll tell you what I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like us to tell a little bit about our sort of relationship to protest over the years and
sure, right.
Like peace team training and things we've done,
things like that. Yeah.
Actions we've done and whether we felt that was useful or not, you know, or how we feel about those things
mm-hmm.
Later. Anyway, so I just highlighted a couple of things. I just skimmed through it again. One of them was, I can't believe that. How people still speak about BLM.
Yeah, no, it's a little absurd.
Because this article highlights that the protests in 2014, the BLM protests in 2014, were protesting killing of more than 40 unarmed black people by law enforcement officers. And when I had not heard that figure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew about the news stories as they came out.
Right.
But I hadn't like done the math and seen like the accumulation
names.
Right. of names. But that's pretty astounding.
Oh, I thought it was low. But yeah, yeah.
Well,
it's definitely astounding.
I mean, there might be a lot of unreported, you know, people in that number, unsung, you know. But I just was thinking. So who could be, you know, what rational person could see this and understand what they were protesting and say, well, all lives matter.
Mm.
You know,
I too have felt pain.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So there was a point that the authors of the first book bring up. Where their protest is experience and protest of virtue signaling and whatnot, and it's there's a line from the book they quote: their messages are mangled by an unsympathetic media smitten by images of property destruction.
Yeah.
Assuming that the media even acknowledges a form of contention that has become increasingly repetitive and boring.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some people I know on my feed who, if there's any at any protest, they immediately focus on
property damage. How
on property damage.
Look at the mess they made.
And you know, one of my conservative friends was just like railing against the protesters at Trump's inauguration, most of which were peaceful. But there were a few, you know, black bloc anarchists or whatnot. There was some, some cars were damaged. I guess they set a limousine on fire.
That happens, yeah.
Now, personally, my response is at a gut level, woohoo! But, yeah, okay, you shouldn't do that. But they kettled protesters, they kettled journalists, they rounded people up, and they anally raped them.
Define kettle.
Yeah, define kettle?
Yep.
Okay, so you you allow people to protest, but you make them protest in a special free speech zone where you basically place them behind a wire mesh enclosure or whatnot. And
oh, there's a next level to that.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
like you say, they come to you and say, "Oh, stand over there."
Yeah, and then
and you're like, "Over here?" Like, yeah, right there. And you go stand there like, okay, that's a crime. I'm going to have to bring you in.
Yeah, well, they direct them around. They give them impossible orders to carry right. out and, you know, to basically to round up people.
Right.
So, but yeah, that, okay, so I'm conflating two things. I'm conflating the free speech zones with the basically herding people into, you know.
Rounding people up.
Yeah.
You know, creating a pretext to round people up.
Right.
And then follow that up with anal rape. And yeah, but you know, they like broke stuff, man.
So these journalists were arrested and you know, my conservative quote friends.
Journalists, protesters.
A lot of journalists too.
Oh, nice.
You know, and was, well, they shouldn't have been, you know.
Shouldn't have been protesting.
Uh-huh. Okay. So the article talks, I'm just skimming through a couple points here. Where there's this talk, and some movements have kind of embraced this sort of leaderless protest, too.
Yeah.
That's sort of driven by events on the ground and is flexible and, you know, allows people. It's sort of so they make a point of talking about how some of these groups, some of these movements try to basically govern themselves with the principles that they espouse, you know, like the anarchist principles they promote.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
You know, or, you know, they're building consensus and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the open question whether on the ground in a protest that kind of structure really actually creates an effective protest or not.
Or what? What you know, what the outcomes are, right?
So there's a lot of blather about how social media tools allow people to have flash mobs and connect mm-hmm. and whatnot and bring about sort of an insta protest quickly, which mm-hmm. which is true. But whether that kind of protest is really
effective
or an improvement on what you know what people have done in the past, or
it's an open question.
It's an open question. Let's see. This point was interesting. Hart and Negri, one of the pair of authors of one of the books, one of their ideas is that the formula, so the classical model of protest strategy, the big idea, the master plan, falls to the movement leaders, while tactics, the signs, the moves, you know, which street you walk up,
walk down, or so, yeah,
is under the control of the actual people on the street.
Right.
And they say one of the Hart and Negri ideas is that you should flip the script.
You'd invert that, yeah.
And so the leaders are actually figuring out how most effectively to run the protest at the ground level, while it's the people
who decide what the protest is about.
What it's about and what they're going to, you know, what they're going right. to, which protests they're going to attend and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I like that idea in many ways because it codifies kind of what I think of how our relationship to government should be. I'm absolutely disgusted and opposed to the cult of personality in government and this idea that, you know, well, if only we could find a strong leader, you know.
Yeah, then maybe we could do something.
To me, a leader is someone who is canny enough to find the right parade to get in front of.
Yeah.
And ethical enough that the people parading aren't so disgusted they detour around this person.
Right? Right, yeah.
So, that was an interesting point, basically, who determines the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about direct action. There's a line, it's assumed that today's style of protest flowed out of the 1960s, but they think...
There was a break.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that this actually, most of these modern protests may have sort of started the May Day Vietnam protest of 1971, 25,000 people blockading bridges and intersections around Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So I was alive then, but I don't, you know, I don't have clear memories of that particular event.
Yes, no, neither do I.
Well, you weren't even alive yet.
So. I was too.
71?
Oh, okay, maybe not.
No, not for two more years.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
I'm thinking of something in 75, sorry.
Okay. But yeah, we've also, this other thing I hear from my conservative friends all the time is that blockading traffic is wrong. You know, like in all cases, obstructing traffic. And I'm like, are you serious?
That's hilarious. Yeah, whatever.
I mean, in your own ideology and its history, shooting people is not wrong, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, how can just, you know, like...
blocking traffic.
A minor, you know, inconveniencing people in traffic to make a
But what
a
if point? An ambulance can't make it to the hospital, Paul?
Yeah, that's why Chris Christie should be arrested.
Yeah.
but no, it's become, honestly, it's become a serious and repeated subject of debate on conservative websites, whether or not it should actually be open season on anyone who protests in traffic, you know, who steps into the street and might interfere with your commute, you know. And
you gotta get to work.
And should you have the right to run them down?
Well, yeah.
So
interesting open question, but carry on.
Anyway, carry on. So, this idea, you do the organizing, movement generals make tactical decisions you have to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
Authority arises from the number of people that showed up, etc. Mentioned this prefigurative politics. You behave according to the rules of the society you hope to create. So if you're like a queer anarchist movement, your organizing is
queer anarchist.
Organized along queer anarchist principles, which, as you might imagine, might
be different.
Be different in the way you do your decision making. Perhaps not as effective as a traditional leader-oriented organization, or
perhaps
maybe we'll see.
It's hard to know in advance.
Okay, so then there was also quite a bit in the article that I found interesting about why the protests of the famed protests of the civil rights movement were so effective.
Yeah.
Even given that if you look at the numbers, a large majorities of Americans were opposed to them.
Oh,
opposed to the protests. So you have this idea that maybe, you know, people might have this idea that like, oh, yeah, who could have opposed, you know.
What kind of a person would be opposed to that? Oh, well, almost everyone.
The bus
your
boycotts
parents,
and the lunch counter sit-ins. The majority of people opposed the lunch counter sit-ins. They said it was disruptive, that black people were pushing too hard and fast.
And, you know,
for
just disrupting daily life.
Disrupting daily life. And that was a bad thing.
And blocking traffic.
Large majority. So it's not what you might imagine. Like, you know, it was just this small old guard of people ready to be overthrown.
Oh, no.
But these protests were very effective, especially at getting, because largely because the media was so sympathetic to them. Right.
I wonder why that. But carry on. Yeah.
But they talk about how they were organized.
Yeah.
And they were not flash mobs.
No, they were organized like the May Day invasion, honestly.
Yeah, they were organized very well. And for example, you know, Rosa Parks, if you just read, say, a typical school child's history about Rosa Parks sitting down on or refusing to give up her seat on the bus, you would have this idea that she was like a spontaneous demonstration that just was the spark that lit this flame. It wasn't actually like that at all.
Not by a long shot.
They planned and picked this, and actually they tried one earlier with someone else.
I don't want it to be too or to sound too staged in this respect.
No.
People were doing this protest, refusing to give up their seat and being arrested. It was that Rosa Parks was the one who they could vet. as sympathetic and a person who could withstand media scrutiny.
Let me just read a little bit here.
Yeah, yeah.
It says, Tufekci describes weeks of careful planning behind the year-long Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. That spring, a black 15-year-old named Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat on a bus and was arrested. Today, though, relatively few people have heard of Claudette Colvin. Why? Drawing on an account by Joanne Robinson, Tufekci tells of the Montgomery NAACP's shrewd process of auditioning icons. Each time, after an arrest on the bus system, organizations at Montgomery discussed whether this was the case around which to launch a campaign, she writes. They decided to keep waiting until the right moment with the right person. Eventually, they found their star, an upstanding middle-aged movement stalwart who would withstand... who could withstand a barrage of media scrutiny, Rosa Parks. So her background was entirely clean as far as arrest record or, you know.
All these things. Right. You know, she was...
There was nothing they could throw at her morally, like, oh, you know, she was an alcoholic.
A loose woman. She's a married, fair-skinned black woman who, you know, was active in the movement.
But this didn't happen. It wasn't a spontaneous protest that happened to be the one that triggered the outrage.
No. They were waiting to launch a campaign for the right... the right moment, the right person to rally around.
Right. So I made a highlight down here. Local organizers bided their time, slowly planning, structuring, and casting what amounted to a work of public theater. And that point comes up again, protest as theater. Mm-hmm. And then building new structures as their plans changed. The protest was expressive in the most confected sense, like cooked as you know, making a cake or something, a masterpiece of control and logistics. It was strategic with the tactics following, and that made all the difference in the world.
Yeah, it did.
So, let's see. Also talks about how a lot of these famous protests, including Occupy, which was portrayed in the media as, you know, a lot of dirty unemployed hippies and anarchists, right?
Yeah.
An awful lot of them had day jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it makes a connection between that and Norman Mailer when he wrote Armies of the Night. And he met people out marching who were actually just like him. You know, they weren't long-haired freaks.
Long-haired dirty hippies.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like those are the parts I highlighted when I just skimmed through this article again, looking at something again. There's looking for points again. But Mark Lilla, the Once and Future Liberal, author of The Once and Future Liberal, talks about whether the idea of protest is overblown and has outlived its usefulness in general, or whether the real work is done through the system. So
yeah,
so he says in his book, we need no more marchers, we need more mayors.
But there's something to that.
Yeah, and you highlighted this a bit too. There's a line: maybe in the end, the system is the powerless person's best bet. And I was curious why you highlighted that, because that seems like a controversial.
Oh, it is, though.
Yeah, okay. So those are the bits I highlighted from the article. Why don't you talk for a while?
Sure. I just wanted to hear what you read when you read it.
Yeah.
Well, and what you saw. Like, do you have a takeaway?
Well, a takeaway is the article, it's a survey of books about protests, and so it brings up some ideas. It doesn't prescribe anything all that hard and all that interesting, but I did find the review of the strategy and tactics of the bus boycott to be interesting. I knew that about Rosa Parks already, that, you know, this wasn't a spontaneous protest, that this was a well-organized... there was a great little bit about the I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah.
How the organizers went out and rented the best and most powerful sound system they could.
Yes.
Because they wanted all Kim's words to be heard really, really clearly. And that seems like a dumb thing, right. But a lot of great speeches could go completely ignored if someone's shouting them through a bullhorn with dead batteries or something.
Right. You know? Well, actually, they specify in the article, or he specifies in the article,
yeah,
that King had given that speech twice before.
Yes.
To large crowds.
Yeah.
And this is the time that everyone remembers.
Yeah, well, also because it was recorded.
It was recorded.
The media was there.
The media was there. It was all set. The stage was set.
And it actually, that was a big seller on vinyl.
Yes. Like, people were buying the record.
Yeah, it was sold, you know, Time Life books or whatever, you know. I mean, you could get this, I don't know, you could get like, if you buy a collections of great American speeches, you'll wind up with a recording of this speech on it as one of the great speeches. But and it was, you know, the reason he was, you know, articulate in part was because he had a decent microphone,
sound system in front of him.
Literally, okay. Articulated well enough for the technology of the time to record it.
Right.
You didn't have 10,000 people with digital recorders and cell phones.
Right. So this review goes through three different books on the subject of protest, and they're all liberal leaning books, right? None of these are like conservative pieces or what modern Americans would refer to as conservative perspectives on protest and the use of protest and how it functions. And he's kind of like leads you a little bit at the beginning, talking about, so this protest happened.
Mm-hmm.
We went to war anyway. And this protest happened.
We went to war anyway. Yeah.
And so on and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this protest happened and the financial industry is still functioning.
Right.
As planned. And so on. And then talks about sort of a Marxist perspective about, you know, maybe protest doesn't work anymore. Maybe protest is just pointless. It's useless. And
there's also a point where he defines the proletariat.
Right, defines the proletariat as, you know, anyone who has to work for a living.
Yeah,
right?
Basically.
And then another...
That's a point to discuss also is that those are also the people that can least afford to just show up at a protest.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Interesting that. And then the... I think another book... Yeah, and I'm not naming all the books.
Yeah.
The has a more sort of sociological perspective on protest and how it functions and how they work.
Unlike the New York Review of Books, there's not like a heading at the top that lists the books and their authors.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the end, the author seems to conclude that, you know, protest is worth it and things happen and we need to learn lessons from our past about how to do protest, mm-hmm. how to protest effectively.
But we need to learn the right lessons.
We need to learn the right lessons.
Like these organized protests really wind up doing more, tend to do more long term than.
He also references the Pussy March. And how
Women's
you know
March.
We all came together and did this, and you know,
and nothing happened.
And nothing happened, right. And. But it was important because we were there. We were there.
Well, you were at the Million Women's
I went to the
March.
Million Woman March.
Which one?
The real one.
1997.
20 years ago this fall.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what did that really accomplish? I mean,
well, actually, and that's actually another good point.
Yeah.
I think. What's the word I'm looking for here? Something that he touches on there. That it was an experience for the people who were there.
Yeah.
Right. And that experience was valuable. And it's part of this thing that he's talking about in the article where it's this experiential thing for the participants and less about policy.
So you were very dismissive of the pussy hats.
Oh God, yes. I have nothing.
And that march in general.
Yeah.
But I was curious whether you had, what could you, in your thoughts, what is the big difference that made like the Million Woman March valuable and the Women's March in?
The Million Woman March included me.
That's it.
Yeah, that's really it.
Included you because you felt it was inclusive from the beginning, or
The
Women's March was really seemed like just a Clinton. It was a Clinton rally.
It's kind of a pro-abortion, pro-choice thing. Yeah. It wasn't really like
They weren't your people.
They weren't my people.
Yeah, you didn't feel welcome.
And from this frame of it being an experiential thing,
right?
Well, then why would it be? You know, why would that be valuable to me?
Right.
Why would that have meaning? And
right. Especially if there's no specific policy focus.
No policy focus. And also, how shall I say, the Million Woman March was much more about coming together as women to support each other.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was very effective, right?
Well, effective in the sense that it got a lot of people engaged.
Well, there's the Million Woman March in 1997 was organized by black women.
Okay.
And open to all women.
Yeah.
But much like black colleges and universities, while open to all, only black people show up.
Right.
Okay. And there's this way in which, for a lot of black people, especially middle-class black people, mm-hmm. You never get to see each other.
Do they also just not feel like, in general, they have sort of permission to do this kind of public protest or civic engagement?
Well, here's the other thing. It was a march and not a protest. It was a gathering and not, you know, a gathering and a rally. You know what I'm saying? So the cops weren't looking to harm anybody.
Yeah.
There wasn't any property damage.
Right.
It was.
Yeah, I don't mean to actually conflate the Women's March and the inaugural protests.
Right.
Because
right.
These were different things.
They were different things. The inaugural protests, the inaugural protests and the Women's March this in 2017 mm-hmm. were not the same event.
No.
And shouldn't be regarded as the same. And similarly, the Million Woman March in 1997 is completely unrelated.
Yeah.
But it is in this category of protest as experience.
Yeah.
Right? It's very much in that category. And full disclosure, I stopped protesting in 2007.
So why don't you?
I don't go to protests anymore.
So why don't you talk about your early history of protests? Because I've heard some of it, of course.
I'm almost ready to talk about that. I have just a little bit more to say about the piece, right? So he talks about these three books, and ultimately concludes that it's worth doing because it's good to connect, and these are the mechanisms that the powerless have to affect policy and to get their needs met. Right?
Riots?
the protests.
Yeah, okay.
Like effective protests when you learn the right lesson and do the and really work it well.
I was just thinking about that the riot is the voice of the voiceless or something.
Right. It's the language of the unheard. So his idea is that, okay, you know, protest is what you can do.
Yeah.
Right? Well, after reading it a couple of times, I've got to take this as a propaganda piece. I don't think this is really like a real piece. I don't think it's a real piece.
I didn't think it was a real piece in the sense that the author doesn't have a strong, clear
point
of view and thesis.
He has no thesis.
Yeah.
Except to tell you, oh, keep protesting.
Yeah. And that's to me what distinguishes the articles that I really like in the New York Review of Books mm-hmm. versus the ones that aren't so good versus maybe, you know, and this one is not an NYRB. This is a New Yorker.
It's New Yorker. And
it's not much of a think piece.
Well, yeah. And I don't mean to trash it as like it's poorly written. No, it's fine.
No.
But he doesn't have much of a thesis.
Right.
Because this is actually propaganda to set the stage for the way you think about protest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is to reinforce that, yeah, it works. You can do it well and everything.
Sure.
Right. And dismisses any kind of Marxist analysis and dismisses
class consciousness
analysis. And dismisses that neoliberalism is even a thing. And effectively,
can I read that?
Please.
Bit? Yeah.
I highlighted that.
You did highlight it and I definitely noticed it.
Because his thesis is not, he's trying to pretend that's not his thesis.
Yeah.
So but he's buried it right there in plain sight.
Unsurprisingly, this realization irks the Jacobins. Hart and Negri, as well as Snerk, Check and Williams rail at length against neoliberalism, in scare quotes.
Scare quote.
A fashionable bugaboo on the left, and thus, unfortunately, a term more often flaunted than defined.
So I'll define it for you here.
I'm sorry, I'm doing a Snarko Chapo house reading style.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism can broadly refer to any program, this is in parentheses, any, you know, for those, for, if in case you don't know. Can broadly refer to any program that involves market liberal policies, privatization, deregulation, etc., and so includes everything from Thatcher's social expenditure reductions to Obama's global trade policies. See,
yeah.
Thatcher and Obama.
Yeah, and does that even make sense?
No.
Right.
A moratorium on its use would help solidify a lot of gaseous debate. That's a very David Brooks sentence, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because this is...
Right.
This is a propaganda piece. Yeah.
So I mentioned, you know, in NYRB, the reviews that I like, the author cites three or four, or sometimes even more, books, mm-hmm. and uses them to
as a jumping off point
to espouse a strong thesis.
Point.
So right. there's an article on the recent history of Israel that's just devastating. That does this, you know.
Yeah. The other little piece that he points out is that, effectively, the best hope the powerless have is the powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
As if that even makes sense.
And that he does kind of denigrate the Marxist authors.
Yeah.
For being silly.
Yeah.
You know, his tone is kind of condescending towards them.
But his
says
goal,
we shouldn't even use that term neoliberalism because it's too vague.
It's too vague, doesn't? Yeah, and think about it. It doesn't even make sense. They're conflating Obama and Thatcher. How could you do that?
Well, you know,
because Obama and Thatcher were using the same program.
Yeah,
that's how.
Yeah. When I use it, I mean Clintonism.
But you know.
But also Bushism. So yeah.
Yes.
So.
But if you want to be nonpartisan about it. You can just call it neoliberalism.
We could go way back. Years ago, we did a podcast and with our friend Don titled Reagan's Eighth Term.
Reagan's Eighth Term, yes.
Basically talking about how we're still, zombie Reagan is still running
the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's breathtaking.
Okay. Yeah.
So so that's my big takeaway, is that this is a neoliberal
perspective,
brushing neoliberalism under the rug,
yeah.
Brushing the reality that our protests don't work under the rug,
mm-hmm.
and basically shutting out any debate about how we might do something that does work.
Do it better.
Might do it better or do something that does work.
Yeah.
And pointedly, he describes in detail the civil rights marches, the civil rights movement, and the way in which it was effective, right?
Yeah.
And he talks about how the reason it was effective is their leaders were very close to the centers of power, and they had connections within the centers of power. So when that fancy sound system went down,
oh yeah, the Army Signal Corps, they were able to recruit
the Army Signal Corps
to come and fix it, yeah.
And so on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing.
Well, that kind of brought that up as the media was sympathetic, right?
The media was, but why is the media ever sympathetic? The media is only ever sympathetic if this is what the elites want.
If this is what the elites want, not just what the ratings are going to want, they define what's going to get ratings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They make that decision. And they make that decision based on what the elites want, because that's how they keep their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's part number one, right? But the thing that he also doesn't unpeel is that in the civil rights movement, the narrative that we have that you read in your school books today is one facet of a many-faceted movement, which included Malcolm X and many revolutionaries,
yeah,
and many people, yeah, with very, very different points of view.
Black Panthers. Who are still considered mostly outside the realm of polite discourse.
Polite conversation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So all those people had a point of view. And it's, yeah, only the people who cozied up to power that got an agenda through. Because it wasn't a black agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It was a white agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the women's movement, you know, the only agenda that comes through is not a women's agenda, but a men's agenda.
Yes.
And so on.
Yeah.
And the only way that agenda gets through is because you have to ask the men for permission to run this agenda. You have to ask the white majority for permission to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the only way you get legislation passed, you end up with a white agenda.
Yep.
And you don't make any progress because, you know what, the protests don't work. So we come up with the same thing. You know, the protests don't work because the only protest that does work is the one that the power structure gives you permission to have. Yeah,
working inside the system. Working inside the system. Which is ultimately what he basically advocates.
Advocates.
Now, I should say, I do, if you can do it, I do advocate you getting involved, especially in local politics. You know, we do need more mayors. You know,
there's another side to this coin that I think.
Yeah.
This is where I think I want to talk more about my own personal experience.
Okay.
Is that I think there's a reality that I think a lot of people know, and this is the reason why people don't just show up in the streets for protests. It's not that people aren't hurting. Mm-hmm. We know they don't work.
Yeah.
We're not confused.
Can I cite one particular little example?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so when the second Gulf War, the war in Iraq was getting ramped up.
Right.
You and I went to a program at Rackham Auditorium on the University of Michigan campus. One of the speakers was Juan Cole.
Juan Cole, yes.
Yeah, who now he's a faculty member in Middle Eastern studies.
He blogs at Informed Consent.
Informed Consent, yeah. And he's a really good thinker. Mm-hmm. And I met him and spoke to him a little bit. One of the points they made opening that talk is that basically they had been told by their contacts within government and whatnot in policy that the debate was over.
Yeah, we're not having a debate anymore.
The debate was over, we were going to war.
Right.
And, you know, then it was all scouring for justification, you know, for the smoking gun, for the weapons of mass destruction, all that.
Right.
All that, you know, remember that whole horrible story. I protested in various ways, but we knew protesting, we knew marching.
Yeah.
That the decision was made. And so all I felt that I was really doing at the time by marching was exorcising some small portion of my personal guilt, my
right.
personal culpability for not being able to stop what was going on. And I was blogging my brains out. I was reading shelf feet of articles, listening to interviews, radio stories. I just decided personally to research the whole Israel-Palestine conflict as deeply as I could.
Yeah.
I was posting impassioned blog articles where I was getting information from CIA websites that contradicted what Fox News was reporting about, you know, all this. I was really into it, but I knew that there was no, you know,
there's no hope.
I couldn't have any, I didn't have an audience and I couldn't have any influence.
Right.
Anyway, so... But like I felt like I did what I could, and so I don't know. Do you sleep better then?
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I think it's telling you to use the word exercise, because like I was saying before, like the Million Woman March in '97, many of these marches, a lot of this protest, is about doing what you can in a world where your voice is made impotent. Right?
Yes. Yes.
Right, so you just do what you can.
Yeah.
Right? And I honestly, one of my favorite things to say is that I affirm always and everywhere the spirit of protest.
Well, we joke about it when the kids are like demanding cookies. We're like, preach it.
Preach.
We affirm the spirit of protest.
Right on.
No, you can't have any cookies. Sorry.
Yeah.
Your voice is not going to be heard.
Not on this topic. Not in this forum.
Yeah.
Right? But I think it's entirely valid and true and legitimate to just do what you can and do what you think is best. And I don't mean to take that from any person anywhere ever.
No.
I don't mean to take that. I don't mean to disrespect that. And I'm not really turning my back on the protests that I did for decades.
Yeah.
Or saying that was like stupid or misguided or even wrong.
Right.
Right. I've just come to see that it's not meeting my needs and my goals, so I've chosen to do other things.
Yeah.
Right? And first, my background. I started protesting in 1984 at Electric Bro.
Good year.
It's a good year. Like that year. How telling is that, right? So, I started protesting in 1984 at Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut. There's a nuclear sub there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hanging out with a lot of, honestly, conservative anti-war people. I got a little cutie in my lap. And
she's wiggling around and smacking her lips.
Yeah. And mostly what we were there to protest nuclear war. We were there to protest nuclear power. And really just had a lot to say and to witness to the wrongness of it. Occasionally there were plowshares actions and whatnot, where people would, if you're not familiar with plowshares actions, it's civil disobedience where you actually destroy property.
Maybe you pour blood on a
warhead, a missile silo, something like that. I mean, you're not blowing up a nuclear warhead. Right? It's not that kind of destruction.
It's symbolic. It's symbolic. Like you cut a fence.
You cut a fence and you pour blood. Yeah. I mean, that's really the, and it's usually your own blood.
It's a deliberate act of law breaking, but you're not actually trying. You're not actually going to succeed in disabling whole American military uprising.
No.
Now I've got the baby.
And that's not really your goal.
Right.
Your goal is to break the law
mm-hmm.
in service to a higher law. That's your goal.
Yep.
Right? And so people
they pick these specific symbolically charged acts.
Yeah, symbolically charged acts at a symbolically charged place.
Let it be my blood that's spilled.
Rather than anyone else's. Yes. Right. And so that's, I have nothing bad to say about any of those experiences. In fact, they were wonderful formative experiences, and I'm grateful for them. By 20 years later, is that right? 20 years later? More than 20 years later?
2007,
so 23 years later.
Yeah.
I'd been protesting all things and everything a lot. That was the same year I started writing Congress, the president, and my local representatives weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a practice of weekly writing my representatives since 1984.
W-E-E-K-L-Y, not W-E-A-K-L-Y. I do it W-E-A-K-L-Y.
It's pretty weak sometimes, though. Just a one-word sort of, polite F-U sometimes.
Now every morning before breakfast, I tweet something nasty at Donald Trump. But
which is,
No, not really. Many days.
But not every day. But in 2007, I have to say, there was no, there wasn't a clarion call. The sky didn't part. There was no, particular thing. That told me to stop.
Yeah.
I was just and I think if it was anything, it was the Iraq invasion and our inability to stop that.
Yeah.
And it was...
that certainly was demoralizing.
It was really demoralizing. Actually, if there was anything, it was actually Barack Obama's campaign.
Uh-huh.
It was clear to me that he was going to win. And it was clear to me... that he was likely to win. And it was clear to me that he...
Was a Republican. Yeah.
And I don't say that... I mean, I was... Full disclosure, I was a college Republican. I was a young Republican. I left the party in 1990.
Uh-huh.
So I know a Republican when I see one, okay? And
His policies were somewhere around Nixon's.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like a Nixon, sort of like a hard right Nixon, if you will. Okay. Yeah. And
he
was further right.
Further than right than Nixon.
Than Nixon. And and he was being hailed as this kind of, I don't even know what to call it. As some kind of success, that his election was some kind of success.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, if that's right, well, then I guess
I'm going to be wrong.
I'm going to be wrong.
Yeah.
I'm going to go home. I don't think I'm playing this game anymore. I'm good.
It was a huge victory for identity politics.
Oh my God, was it ever. and I don't want to trash talk identity politics per se.
Not entirely. I mean, I always want to remind myself that for many, many people, just the fact of his victory was a huge...
No, my mother campaigned for him in her wheelchair.
Yeah, it was a huge personal and significant thing that happened in American history. It was historic.
It was historic.
Absolutely.
And I don't entirely mean to dismiss that. And I don't entirely mean to dismiss identity politics. What I do mean to dismiss is the cynical use of identity politics,
which I intend
to dismiss and disparage wholly,
yep.
Because identity politics is very cynically used and manipulated on the national stage, and it's perverse and it's obscene, and it's the way we can get so many things thrown under the bus that really matter, And that's not to say that identity politics don't matter, but their cynical use does not matter at all.
Right.
It's useless. It's pointless. It's a charade.
Can I ask you to mention a protest of actually a local event that we were both involved in that I felt like didn't win exactly, but was significant and maybe felt more successful?
Which was that?
The border strike.
Oh, God, that was so... Yeah, no, that was good. That was really good. I really... The border strike was pretty amazing. That was 2003.
Yeah.
2003-04.
That's something we did together when I could leave work.
When you could leave work. And it was actually part of my job at the time.
It was part of your job at the time. And
with our only child
at the time. We did it with our child at the time.
Right.
And I had a peanut butter drum around my neck that I beat on with drumsticks. Yeah. So I marched and picketed and beat the drum.
We held the picket line. We ran a little soup's kitchen on the street corner for anyone who was at the picket line.
Feeding the homeless.
Feeding homeless people. Feeding people who were on strike to try and negotiate a union contract with Borders. Right. Borders, does anyone remember Borders at this point?
Borders,
you know what I'm talking about?
Borders started out as a single bookstore in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was a fantastic bookstore.
It was really special.
It was really actually one of the reasons that I wanted to move to Ann Arbor, was to be around this place. And I probably spent a quarter of my paycheck for years and years at Borders
Bookstore.
I'd go in looking for one thing, and I'd come home with like a bag of six hardcover books. And I remember buying Randy Schultz, The Band Played On, about the AIDS epidemic, right? Realizing that I was fascinated by this topic, but also I wasn't going to get through this 1,000-page, meticulously researched brick of a book, Really, I needed the Cliff's Notes. The phrase, your eyes are bigger than your stomach.
Yeah.
Like, for as far as reading went in those years, I was always struggling because I wanted to read and study and understand everything.
There was not nearly enough time, not
enough hours of the day. I was ruining my eyes. But that was Borders that I loved. Borders actually metastasized and went cancerous
across the nation,
went viral, so to speak, and turned into a chain. And not to offend in particular anyone who managed it, but that growth was horribly mismanaged.
Yeah,
As far as trying to compete with Amazon and then...
Well, and also Walden Books. Remember Walden Books?
Yeah,
They were trying to compete with them too, which I think ended up getting... Did they get absorbed by Barnes & Noble?
I don't even remember.
I forget what the trajectory was. But anyway, then their other big competitor was Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And instead of being themselves and doing what they did well, they just became like a gift store that also sold books.
Yeah, it was pretty appalling, actually, to have the whole first floor of this flagship store was largely calendars,
all kinds of tchotchkes and stuffed animals.
Yeah,
but all that said, it came to pass that in the year 2003 and 2004,
it came to pass.
Yeah, that people who had been
hook her up. She's trying to nurse on my shoulder.
People who had been working there for 10, 15 years, were making barely enough to make ends meet. People starting to work there, some of them had PhDs.
Yeah, they really were trying to make a career out of working at a bookseller.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's what they told us too. They thought of themselves as booksellers as a career.
Right.
And working their way up to purchasers and all this floor managers and whatnot,
et cetera. It was not a living wage. It was really not enough to live on in Ann Arbor.
Yeah. It's only gotten worse, by the way.
It hasn't gotten any better. But they were trying to negotiate a union contract so they could have an entry wage that was, really not much, like $10 an hour.
Yeah. I never felt like their demands were excessive.
No, they weren't excessive in any way.
No.
And enough to like some sort of guaranteed structure for moving up.
For raises.
For raises and moving forward in your career.
So the idea being that people who worked in Ann Arbor for years and years and years supposedly,
would have some job security
at this flagship store, actually could afford to live somewhere in the area.
Somewhere in the area and make a career of this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And
not have to work two jobs.
Not to work two jobs so they can sell books at Borders.
Right.
So they went on strike because they were trying to negotiate a contract, and Borders was kind of, well, Borders was dicking around about it.
Yeah.
And they were on strike and on strike and on strike. And I think this was several months. And
it dragged on. It started in the summer.
It started in the summer and really dragged
out all the way into the fall.
Into the fall and up to Christmas, right?
Yep.
And Dennis Kucinich came and marched on the picket line with us as part of his campaigning.
Oh God, I forgot
in the
about
election
that.
Cycle. Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. And I worked this strike hard. Yeah. It was part of my job at the time.
Yeah, you were
working with ICPJ, right. The Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, and yeah. I was organizing religious support for union organizing.
No, I had a day job. I couldn't spend every hour on that.
Which I did a lot of networking and coordinating to get people there to get this strike in the news and make it
to
make the strike stick.
You were trying to raise awareness through the churches too.
The churches too.
Yeah.
And also get the churches to at least respect the picket line and not cross the picket line.
Right. And do you want to mention a particular...
I'm not going to mention that person.
Okay.
I have nothing nice to say. I'm not going to... Anyway.
A very high profile clergyman crossed the picket line while we actually begged him not to.
Begged him not to do his Christmas shopping.
It was appalling.
It was just repulsive.
It just reminds us of how, you know, clergymen, church officials, whatever, can be, you know, considered to such moral and holy and respectable
people.
They can
have blind spots.
Yeah, that's all it was.
That's all it was. So. And lots of people talk about how I'm going to shop here. I love shopping here. I'm like,
oh, why would I inconvenience myself? I tried not to be obnoxious, but you know, we were making noise because that's what a picket line does, right? And we had people come and lecture us for making it so they couldn't have a conversation across the street.
Or you know, but how rude it was to block people coming in. It's a picket line.
Yeah. And so I would say, you know, these people aren't actually here for your convenience. Woman like pointed her finger at me and said, "That's it. That's the attitude." You know, it's like, that's the attitude that you're guilty of, that I'm offended by or something like that's why you're never going to get, you know, your way. Or whatever.
Oh, well,
that's this snotty attitude. That's the attitude. Yes, we have an attitude that, I mean, I say we. I was just a guy
who
showed up. I wasn't working at Borders.
Right.
I had a software engineering job, you know,
but
wanted to support them and support you doing this thing.
Right.
But I started to feel like these people are really getting shafted, and you can see the contempt in the eyes of the people.
They serve.
And that was actually...
It was repulsive.
Yeah. Very disappointing and saddening.
But I have to tell the happy ending. So the happy ending is, and it's my favorite happy ending ever, right? So... It's getting on to the Christmas season. We were picketing past through Thanksgiving.
Yep. It was cold.
It was cold. It was so like the first week in December, last week in November, right after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And a Teamster comes up to make a delivery at Borders. And we're out front with our picket line.
Yeah.
And he pulls up and he looks at us and says, "Wait a minute. Are you guys picketing?"
What was your first clue?
I'm like, yeah. And he said, "Oh, the Teamsters don't cross a picket line. We're not going to deliver at any store that has a picket line." And he kept driving with their delivery.
So awesome.
It was beautiful, right?
As we talk about this, I'm actually standing here in front of a microphone staring, because it's in our little storage room here where we're recording. There's a big banner.
Yeah.
And the top line of the banner is the hand cut out, crudely sort of glued on felt letters that spell out in letters like 2 feet high, "Solidarity." And like, there it is.
There
it was.
We don't cross a picket line, and just kept driving.
Yeah.
And he said, and like, I talked to the Teamsters later. It was like, you don't cross a picket line. You know, three more people picketing, we don't cross. So we organized picket lines at every Borders we could find because that would stop their deliveries from showing up.
Yeah.
And so now, the first week of the big Christmas shopping season, the Teamsters don't deliver. And they had to get FedEx.
They were like UPS was teams organized by the Teamsters. Maybe.
I don't think that's true. I think they had a private carrier.
A freight carrier. Okay.
That was
their regular delivery company was organized
by the Teamsters.
Yeah.
So they actually had to, no, because UPS and Federal Express cost an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
And they had to get everything, all their shippings, they had to get.
In the Christmas season.
In the Christmas season.
Yeah, their biggest shopping.
Through FedEx and UPS.
All their calendars.
They sat down to negotiate in 7 days.
That's great.
I kid you not.
Yep.
It was glorious. And it's that, it was that kind of like, how shall I say, the folks that were doing the organizing, they were trying to establish a union, weren't like union veterans.
No,
I was not by any means a union veteran.
They were mostly in their 20s or 30s.
A couple of folks who were, you know, been around the block.
But they were...
But largely young.
They were just nerds that worked at Borders.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Not to denigrate them, but they didn't, like... But,
yeah.
They weren't at professional activists.
They weren't professional activists or professional union organizers.
Yeah.
And neither was I.
No.
I had a long history of activism and had some understanding about how to organize things, but really, we had to just kind of get out there and walk on the sidewalk for months until we could figure out what to do that would be effective.
And it was somewhat of an accident that this came together like that.
Right. And I'm like, did the Teamsters not see us here for the last how many months? I mean, what?
Yeah. You know? Maybe they were... Delivering
some other way. I don't know.
Entrance.
I don't know. I still don't know.
Yeah. Right.
But no, that, and now mind you, of course,
mm-hmm.
there will be the person who would notice this. So, you know, Borders shut down. Maybe, you know, unionizing just destroyed their business.
It was a drop in the bucket in their hemorrhage of their tide of red ink.
Tide of red ink against Amazon.
But it is true. They didn't last much longer after
they did
this.
They did not last that much longer.
Yeah.
And yes, it, just for the person who really feels like they've got to go there,
mm-hmm.
The benefits that they won in negotiating
mm-hmm.
were literally a drop in the bucket compared to how they were hemorrhaging against Amazon and against online book sales.
No,
they just could not keep up.
I stand by my original description of what went wrong with Borders, which is that it was a wonderful bookstore that turned into a metastatic bookstore cancer.
Yeah.
And people thought, oh, we really need to drive this towards these huge, big brick and mortar operations all over the place.
All over the country.
Hundreds of stores. It'll be great. And they grew way, way, way too fast. It all
too
happened
fast.
In a period of a couple of years suddenly.
Like less than 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
It was really perverse.
There were all these Borders and they were super overextended.
Yeah.
A lot of them weren't actually profitable, you know.
And like a lot of liberal universities are top heavy in administration.
Yeah, the Borders was top-heavy administration. Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Right. So, no, it was this push towards growth. Growth at all costs. It kills the organism.
Yeah. So, you know, it was... so it's too bad. I suspect, if you really want to go there, I suspect if they had unionized earlier, they might have lasted longer.
It's conceivable. It's really,
I think it's conceivable.
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say, but it's very hard to say because you can't play what if. But seriously, the kind of person that sold books at Borders cared about the bookstore.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so I just wanted to have an example out there of protesting a local issue that we felt did something, even if it just showed solidarity.
And now here's the thing, again, to learn, even if you just showed solidarity, the people who were on the line who were trying to get a decent wage, it meant everything to them because we were collecting money so they could have a strike fund and helping them pay their rent to have the support that they had.
Right.
It really mattered to those people in that place at that time. And this, again, is why I don't mean to suggest that protest is stupid or bad.
Yeah.
Only that it's ineffective because really our protest, our marching in front of the store did nothing.
Yeah.
It was the solidarity with other union workers where we pinched them where they cared.
A bigger union that finally sort of hit them where they
hit it where it count.
Yeah.
Hit them where they lived, hit them where it count. That actually caused change.
Right.
Because basically, and that's all protest ever originated as, in the history of protest, the point has always been to disrupt what's happening so the oppression can't continue.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we're going to stop your ships from shipping. We're going to stop your deliveries from happening.
And we're going to raise awareness, if necessary, by blocking traffic. You're going to be inconvenienced.
You're going to be inconvenienced.
It's going to be loud and messy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and to say that, you know, well, that's not well, polite.
That's unprofessional. That's, you know, to imply.
They're breaking the law. Well,
Yeah,
because the law is always on the side of right, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Legality always means it's right. So that,
I mean, you know, the execution of 6 million Jews was all conducted fully under the auspices of the legal system. Yeah. Right?
So, you know, Lincoln's mass hanging was legal.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't talk to me about legal.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thought that was interesting. You and I actually started off our sort of exercises in protest. We're both on the same subject. We were both sort of anti-nuclear activists.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was getting in trouble with teachers in high school writing review, you know, papers about Jonathan Schell's The Fate of the Earth and you know, and people like talk to me like, oh, you've changed since high school. I'm like, no, you never knew me in high school. I'm the guy that wrote a paper about the Fabian Society, you know, about English socialism, right? I mean, I was
still that guy.
Yeah, very
the guy hasn't left.
Yeah, so very much to the left of my family too, let's say.
Well, I think the lesson to be learned, the lesson to be taken, I thought it was very insightful. The one little clip of insightful thing I saw in the article was this idea that you want to invert the structure so that the goals of the protest are grassroots.
Yeah.
And the tactics and the strategy is maybe, I don't want to say engineered
People can actually sit down in a room and have a meeting.
Yeah, people sit down and have a meeting and think about it.
Yeah, outside of the heat of the moment.
Right. In a conscious way,
yeah.
About what strategy is really going to be effective here,
yeah.
And really get us what we need. Because I think if we'd had one veteran union organizer months before, we probably could have taken that strategy much earlier and been much more effective.
Of gaining some solidarity with
other unions.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I doubt if it would have been nearly as effective as the first week of the Christmas season.
Yes, that's true. No, but it's... yeah, but I keep thinking about this. I mean, because, you know, I've marched in protest of... I mean, I don't want to get into the free speech thing because that's another big topic of what the nature of a protest and all that. But I keep thinking I want the kids to have this experience of going to a march or a protest. Things get a little weird when you get older. Like, you know, if one of us does wind up doing some action, getting kettled, getting arrested, whatnot, you know, we both get arrested, our kids will be taken away by Child Protective Services.
Yeah, that could be cool. Yeah.
Even one of us, that still could be the case.
Indeed.
You know, and it's not so easy to put yourself on the line with a family and a career and, you know,
et cetera.
Because the consequences extend far beyond you, you know, it's just who will have like a, you know, do you have a criminal record? Well, yes.
Yeah, I'm supposed to say that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the consequences are deep. Well, and here's the thing, the consequences are deep and just showing up at the inauguration.
Yeah.
Right.
Could have got you kettled and finger banged by a thug with a glove and a
A glove and no lube.
Well, who was going down the line using the same glove on everyone. Right. Yeah.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, hallelujah.
And to what end? And to what end?
Right. What have you accomplished?
What have you accomplished?
Yeah.
So, and that's, I think, is a very legitimate question.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, I think if protest is to be effective, you're going to have to take the risks.
I would love to see our kids, as they get old enough, schooled like I was in like this peace team activity.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Peace training.
Peace team training, what to do, what not to do in a protest, you know.
Right. The nonviolence training.
Nonviolence training, how to put your body on the line, you know.
Yeah.
At the same time that I don't actually want to expose them to risk. So this, you know, to grave personal risk. But this was like the situation in Charlottesville, you know, is people are jumping on Antifa. But on the you know, protester side, they showed up heavily armed.
They showed up heavily
armed. I'm still amazed that I guess one guy did point just a gun at someone and tried to fire it, but the safety was on or something. He didn't even know how to operate his own gun. But responsible gun owner. So many of them, well, that's true of most of these folks that claim to be, but responsible gun owner. So many of them were heavily armed that the idea that you're going to go counter-protest in that environment, that is...
It's risky.
That's really risky in a way that, you know, just like getting beat up is not, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you all... Especially in this environment now where people are seriously talking about how running down protesters with their cars is...
Makes sense.
Makes sense. And it's legitimate. They talked about it on these websites for weeks and months leading up to
weeks and months. Events. But, you know, it only makes sense and, you know, I guess anything wrong with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, are we going to teach our kids to counter-protest in that kind of a setting?
It's a good question.
But I do want to get them... used to the idea of, you know, I want to affirm their spirit of protest.
Well, here's the thing. My parents were long time, my parents were part of the civil rights movement.
Yep.
And they never took us to protests.
Yeah.
But when I wanted to protest,
yeah,
they were happy to drive me anywhere I wanted to go in the region.
Okay.
Yeah. And they would just get in the car and take me. And, you know, said, you know, call if you need a thing.
If you need us to bail you out.
If you need to bail you out or anything.
Yeah.
And I was pretty young. I didn't realize how young I was until just now when I thought about it. I think I was Sam's age.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was Sam's age.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was doing things in public, not protests per se, but at a very young age that when I think back on it now, I'm kind of shocked that what? I was doing. So like...
So what?
I was going to adult user group meetings and getting up and giving an hour presentation on programming at 12.
At 12,
you know,
yeah.
Right?
It's usual, really. It's usual.
So we were both precocious in some ways.
In some ways.
You know.
So I think if my conclusions, my thoughts on what all this means.
Yeah.
I don't think any protest that most of us are familiar with in the last 30 years
is effective per se.
It's effective. I don't think it's effective at policy.
We're not changing. We're not able to stop wars anymore.
We're not able to stop wars. You're not able to change the course. And to be clear, it didn't really stop the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to be clear about that.
It wasn't, like you say, it wasn't until the people in power sort of turned against.
And then it gets manipulated so that it looks like they're responding to public interest.
To public outcry.
Public outcry.
The collective revulsion.
But they've made some decision and then, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, all that aside, here's what I think does happen, right?
Yeah.
I think it's possible for you to be disruptive and disruptive in a critical way. If you can actually stop something critical from happening that needs to happen for the people in power, then you have their attention.
Are you thinking of the pipeline protests?
I'm thinking of the pipeline protests.
Yeah.
And they will have to call in the goons to stop you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
And if you can put your body on
the line... That's...
And get on TV.
And get on TV, that's what that's for. That's what that's about.
Right.
That's why so many natives showed up in South Dakota at Standing Rock for... months.
Yeah.
And I think that was native led and eventually called off when it looked like it was going to actually start killing people.
Yeah.
You know, the media was kind of...
Well, they were going to freeze to death.
Well, it wasn't just that. They were making fortifications to last the winter, but the goons were starting to get serious about killing people.
They were hiring mercenaries.
Yeah. Right. It was about to get really ugly. And they decided to, you know, not to cost anybody's life.
Right.
Which I think was ultimately a responsible decision.
Mm-hmm.
But, and if you recall, it was just a long time before there was any kind of media attention or whatnot to really look at what was happening at Standing Rock.
Yeah.
And because, you know, the elites didn't want to do anything about this.
No.
Right? So...
It's part of too many people's retirement portfolios.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
Energy companies.
And Blue they chip. Did, a, and they really did a full court press. The it's the Standing Rock organizers did a full court press where they're actually, they left the physical protest and they're still in the courts, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they stopped and slowed enough that they could get a court case moving. So they have standing in court and can then move forward and move forward. Ultimately, to have them fighting on so many fronts that maybe at some point they have to give because it's costing them too much. Maybe at some point they have to give because, yeah, they're going to have to kill somebody before they can move forward with building and so on. And I think really that they didn't want to call their bluff on having a goon, a mercenary, take somebody out who's on the physical, doing the physical protest. And I can't fault anybody for making that decision.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where it has to go, and that's what it has to be. You can't be showing up in D.C.
It's a march.
And shaking hands with the cops and taking pictures in your hat.
Selfies.
And taking selfies.
Yeah. No, that's a march. That's a parade.
That's a parade.
And not a
That's not a protest. Protest. That's a parade.
Honestly, it's true. You've commented, too. If the cops are there marching with you,
that's
and
a parade.
Not trying to kettle you or you know, or round you up
or
confine you to a free speech zone. It's a parade.
It's a parade. And I don't think there's anything wrong with parades. Go on a parade. That's cool. But don't think it's anything other than a parade.
And, you know, the Nazi marchers in Charlottesville were having a parade because the cops were...
I want them. So, yeah. You do your thing. It's, and to the end that maybe your parade is to let other people know that they're not alone.
Yeah, yeah.
To the end that, it's to affirm your identity. To the end that it's an experience. My closest friends went to the Women's March, and she had a great time. It was an experience. And that was the first thing she said. I had the full march experience.
The march experience.
Yes.
Yeah, like the Jimi Hendrix experience.
Yeah, you went the whole way, had the whole thing, did it all. But don't think that that's a policy changing event or action.
No, it's a vacation.
It's a vacation. It's a weird, exhausting vacation, but it's a vacation.
Yeah.
But no, if you can interrupt the cogs of the wheel and really be a problem,
yeah,
then you have some hope of maybe getting things to be different.
Right.
If you can really stake out the space and the claim that, you know what, this problem's not going away until you do X,
mm-hmm.
full stop,
mm-hmm.
which is the only way to handle any sort of problem child. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So absent that, I don't think showing up to march in DC is going to do anything for you. The March for Life has been there.
Right.
44 years, every January, right. There we are,
right.
In force. Nothing's happened. I mean, not really.
Not much.
Not much, really.
So I think I want to end on this question of, I had someone on Facebook say basically, you're really quick to criticize other people and jump on other people's politics and their actions and all that.
What are you doing?
But what are you doing? Now, let's take it as a straight question and all sarcastic and snotty.
I'm not right. Maybe I should just be quiet for this one. Go ahead.
Because I've thought about it a lot since then, actually. Because no, I'm not actually out on the street. I'm not wearing a hoodie and a face mask to defend against skinheads marching in our town.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a day job, and we have six children here at home,
mm-hmm.
and. So part of my answer is, well, I get up, I chop wood and carry water,
Yeah.
And a lot of my activism, if you want to call it that, takes the form that it's largely always taken in my life, which is reading and writing. And now, for the last decade or so, this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And maybe that's ineffective. But it is something. It eats time, and it requires thought and effort. But I'm not I'm not traveling around the country to go to marches. I have protested. I know what tear gas smells like.
And to be fair, Standing Rock almost brought me out of protest retirement.
We were giving serious thought to sending you out there.
Yeah.
But also just, there are certain realities to be confronted, like childcare.
Like childcare. Childbirth.
Childbirth. Yes, you were pregnant.
Yeah, I was heavily pregnant at the time. But now I... Yeah.
And some things are just too risky, you know?
Although, yeah.
I know. Some people have a higher tolerance for risk than others. But,
sure.
But we feel pretty heavily our responsibilities towards keeping our family safe and together here.
Yeah. Well, I think I should also just have a little epilogue about...
Please.
About, like, so, you know, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So if I retired from protest in 2007, what have I been doing for the last 10 years? What, you know, did I just pack up and go home and, you know...
Well, you stopped being a professional community organizer.
I stopped being a professional community organizer. I stopped attending protests and going to protests.
But at some point, I want to do a podcast about basically what we did in Saginaw for 7 years. And,
right.
And I think in that context, we should talk about your
my unprofessional.
Your amateur community organizing.
Amateur organizing. It was really amateurish. It was sad. But seriously.
Unpaid or barely paid.
Barely paid. Yeah, unpaid. But seriously, what I did take from my... quote, retirement from protest,
mm-hmm.
was that it was time to stop going to protest and start living in protest. And so that's a different thing altogether. If you want to ask me, okay, what do I need to do? You need to interrupt your oppressors. That's what you need to do. Going to D.C. does not interrupt your oppressors. It gives them more money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you want to know what to do, you should interrupt them and what they're doing and make it difficult for them to continue doing what they're doing. However that works for you. So you do with that what you need to do. But for me, my revelation about protests' ineffectiveness meant that my life needed to be lived in protest. And that was really embracing what Dorothy Day calls a revolution of the heart. That if there's something I can change, it's me and what I'm doing and the sphere I'm closest, most connected to. I can actually live differently. I can choose to do things differently. And part of that was moving to Saginaw. Part of that was establishing cooperatives and working with marginalized people mm-hmm. as closely as I could.
Mm-hmm. And that hasn't really stopped.
And that hasn't stopped. That hasn't gone away.
No.
And I think in doing those things, I do my best to interrupt the people that are holding me back, the people that are repressing me.
Yeah. And I'm doing my best to actually not waste all my time on Facebook.
Oh, come on.
It's very seductive.
It is very seductive.
All right. I think you want to end there?
I think we can end there.
I think we should end there. Okay, thanks for listening, everyone.
See you next time.
Because it's very late, and I'm actually going into work tomorrow on Labor Day.
How fitting.
How sad is that?
That's fitting.
It's fitting. I'm going to... I have stuff to get done, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and just not even edit this and quick get it processed and up tonight. And
sounds good.
See what happens. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.